21st, at a recent rally hosted by President Trump this month, a number of attendants brandished signs emblazoned with the letter Q, showing their support for an internet conspiracy theory that's gathered a number of followers around the country. Conspiracy theories are nothing new. There have been speculations about governmental misdeeds, weather control, secret societies, just to name a few, for years, decades. But over the last couple of years, conspiracy theories have jumped from conversations online to the real world. For example, in December 2016, an armed North Carolina man arrived at a D.C. pizza place to investigate a supposed child sex ring, which was the center of an unsubstantiated conspiracy theory, and he discharged his weapon while there. While no one was hurt, the incident shined a light on the potential danger of conspiracy theories. Our next guest is here to talk about why conspiracy theories seem to be spreading a lot, how they've jumped into the mainstream, and the communities that spring up around specific theories. Keith Brown is a politics and global studies professor and director of Arizona State University's Malikian Center. Keith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
Well, as we mentioned, conspiracy theories aren't new. They go back a long time. Can you talk a little bit about the history of conspiracy theories and how they crop up?
Sure. Well, they tend to crop up a lot in conditions of political polarization is one. It's one determining factor. Another is a sense of powerlessness among groups, sort of lack of control over their own destinies. And coupled with that comes a belief in a malign or evil or super powerful, super secret other, often sort of lurking in full sight and yet with some hidden dimensions. And that other is attributed all kinds of agency bringing about the misfortune of the person who believes in conspiracy theories. So that's the kind of heady brew we get.
And they spread quickly on the internet, but clearly you don't need to have an internet to have conspiracy theories. They managed to spread, right, in pre-internet days.
They did. I think what's happened with the internet is the speed at which they circulate has just accelerated rapidly. But we can go back to Virgil's Aeneid, who talks about rumor having the fastest wings of anything. So the idea that falsehoods whispered around, especially through communities which don't have long traditions of trusting or looking for multiple sources for things, there's a long history of how quickly malign ideas can spread.
Well, I want to step away from the United States a little. A lot of your research in politics specializes in Eastern Europe and in the Balkan states. Can you talk about, and there are obviously a lot of conflicts between communities and countries there over the years, can you talk about how conspiracy theories have risen and spread in those areas that you've researched?
Sure. I mean, one of the clearest examples is in Kosovo, the region of former Yugoslavia, which is part of Serbia, where you've got a majority Albanian population and a minority Serbian population, but it's a part of the world that Serbian politicians especially feel very strongly belongs to Serbia. So you've got two communities living alongside each other, but with very different ideas of history, often without very much contact. And what can happen in a situation like that is an incident can just trigger the kind of a particular interpretation that then causes violence. So an example from the late 1990s, three Serbian boys drowned in a river, three Albanian boys drowned in a river, and the rumor quickly spread as they had been chased into the river by Serbs with dogs. There's no evidence that that actually happened, but once that idea takes hold, and especially if it resonates with a larger climate of distrust between communities, then you can see riots, particular kinds of ethnic violence coming as a result, whereby somehow it stems from a tragic accident involving three Albanian boys to the Serbs did it, to every Serb is our enemy, and so you get violence as a result.
Yeah, I wonder, and it's probably hard to tease out exactly how much this happens, but we could say, okay, there was this mistrust between two communities in that case. Maybe violence would have occurred anyway. How much can we say, okay, the conspiracy theories themselves exacerbate violence like that?
Well, I think the thing about conspiracy theories is they're a kind of sense-making, and there's a kind of, I think we're all, you know, we all actually want to believe that there are facts in the world, and we all take particular examples and particular stories as really powerful instruments in sense-making. So I agree, you have a generalized climate, but it's those incidents, those trigger flashpoints that often provide a kind of fake concreteness. They provide a concreteness which from a distance we can say, look, that's not what happened, but the concreteness is what makes the story believable. You tell someone a story where you say, well, it happened under that tree, and suddenly you've just endowed it with extra meaning and traction for someone because they can actually begin to visualize it, imagine the locality of it. So I think there is something about the specific incidents and the ways that, as you mentioned in the pizza case, you know, something very concrete gets a whole set of meanings attached to it. But it's when it has a particular locus and a particular trajectory that resonates with someone hearing that story, that they can somehow believe in it because there's a place attached to it and there's a concreteness attached to it. That's when it gets really dangerous.
Talking to Keith Brown about conspiracy theories and how they spread, why they persist. He's with Arizona State University. He's a politics and global studies professor there. Keith, let's talk about how it is so difficult or can be difficult to argue against a conspiracy theory, because once someone's bought into that alternate view, that interpretation of facts, any counter-argument, it just shows that the person making the counter-argument is part of the problem, agreeing with the conspiracy. Is that right?
I think that's right. There's a real kind of boundedness, a kind of internal universe that gets created around conspiracy theory. And so you try to present evidence, and as you've said, if the evidence fits with the conspiracy theory, then the conspiracy theorist embraces it immediately. If it's evidence that can be turned into fitting into the theory, again, it's embraced. But if it's evidence that just kind of rams against the outside of that hard shell of the universe as the conspiracy theorist believes it, then, it, as you said, it'll be discredited. The attack will go after the person trying to introduce the new evidence has somehow just outed themselves as part of this evil, all-powerful they that I described at the beginning as being such a central part of the construct of the conspiracy theorist.
You mentioned a feeling of powerlessness making people buy into conspiracy theories, but I wanted to ask about when people in power use them. I'm thinking, for example, of Imperial Russia promoting anti-Semitic conspiracy theories leading to pogroms in the country, massive campaigns against the Jews who lived in Russia, and that continues to today. Can you talk about people at the head of countries deploying conspiracy theories as a weapon?
Sure. I mean, I think it is, as you point out, it's a terrible, tragic situation of manipulation. It's part of many of our notion of government is to actually be damping down misinformation and to actually be moving towards creating a better educated citizenry, instilling attitudes of critical thinking, of speaking against falsehood. There's a famous incident, I think, in the election campaign between Senator McCain and President Obama, when Senator McCain at a rally just said no to some of his would-be voters when they were speculating about conspiracy theorists involving the Democrats. It takes a certain principled form of Democrat and commitment to this idea of we need to stay true, we need to stick to the facts here. Through chaos, no one wins, and that's not always, not all governments follow that pathway of what their obligations are.
I know a quandary in the media is how and whether to cover a conspiracy theory by debunking. Some people argue that by talking about them and even trying to debunk them, they still help to promote them, help spread the word about them. Do you have thoughts on that?
It's certainly a dilemma. I think talking about the broader idea of conspiracy theories, where they come from, sort of putting this in a larger historical context, maybe pointing to examples of where conspiracy theories an embrace of them, especially, and promotion of them by governments where they've led societies. And also maybe just every so often, you know, making the point, which is, I think, central to debunking conspiracy theory, we have to just acknowledge that coincidence happens, chance happens, and not everything has a... it's not always the case that everything is connected. It's tricky because part of my job as a social scientist is to examine connections and trace patterns and see things and sort of explain that, you know, this looks like a coincidence, but actually it's part of a larger pattern. And so I think news responsible news organizations do the same thing, pointing to connections, pointing to the way things are actually influencing each other in the world. It's tricky because we know after 9/11, there are conspiracies in the world. So it's a really fine line that that news organizations need to tread. But I think, as you've suggested, sort of the kind of outright debunking is not, I don't think, it's not a way to shift people's well belief by sort of expecting the aha moment by presenting one devastating counterexample. You know, despite the fantasies of what we think scholarship is about and what we think courtrooms are about, it's actually more the incremental work of shifting the dialogue, of engaging people in conversation. And I think, and this is sort of part of my own work in the Republic of Macedonia, where I think it is a place where conspiracy theories can flourish, to actually sit down and be prepared to have the conversation and sort of ask people to walk through the steps that are involved. And I think what you then see is something that Ali Hochschild, the sociologist, described as seeing what the deep story that an individual or a community are organizing around. Like, what is the deep story that people hold? And once you understand the deep story and the sense that that story makes, then to think about, okay, what parts of this story, what are the missing parts? What is the piece that this community aren't aware of? What could be integrated into this story? And what is the underlying socioeconomic basis that is pushing people to believe a particular narrative? I think that's the pathway forward, and I think news organizations have a powerful role to play in that.
We're talking to Keith Brown right now about how and why conspiracy theories spread and how they've changed in the age of the Internet. He's a politics and global studies professor and director of Arizona State University's Malikian Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions, what observations do you have about why conspiracy theories spread? What impact do you think they have on political discourse, on modern politics, maybe in the United States? And how do you think the Internet fits into this? How do you think it has changed the way these conspiracy theories spread? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. Right now, we continue our conversation about how and why conspiracy theories spread and why they seem to be spreading so quickly, especially in the age of the Internet. Keith Brown is with us, politics and global studies professor at Arizona State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you encounter conspiracy theories more in your day-to-day life than you used to? Do you think they're spreading further and faster? Do you think it's because of the Internet? Do you worry about their real-world impact? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to Brian on the line in Oshkosh. Brian, hello.
Hey, how are you doing today? Hey, I'm not so concerned about the originating and spreading of conspiracy theories. What I'm concerned about is the consistency that I see with people who should know the facts logically and refuse to change their mind. For example, let's take a look at the flat earth theory. When that first came out, I originally thought it was a joke, but I've been following some of the websites, and some of these people are very sincere in their belief that the earth is not a sphere, but actually a flat surface, disc in shape, and proof is that you can go up in the air and you can look out and you can see a circular horizon. Now, confronted with the facts, all that are out there, all the data that's out there, What is making this thing have legs and mobility?
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. So, Keith, in a pretty demonstrably wrong theory like this, why, and maybe we need to get into psychology to talk about this, I don't know, why would people persist in a belief like that?
Yeah, thanks for the observation. I mean, I think what the caller's pointing to is, there's a real sort of scientific illiteracy, let's say, at the heart of this, and a replacement of it with a kind of common sense, a notion of common sense that somehow is taken to trump the invisible evidence, the evidence the scientists might come up with. So one of the other elements I would point to is a climate in which, for one reason or another, expertise or professionalism has been discredited or discounted. And some of that is self-inflicted. So I don't know if your listeners remember, there was a case from the UK where one climate change lab got one set of data wrong. It immediately published a retraction, apology, like corrected the mistake. But once a mistake like that is out there and the word of a mistake gets out like that, then again, we slip into this kind of form of scientific illiteracy where people, and I would include myself in this, I'm a humanist by training, you know, we don't always understand probability. We don't understand that, you know, one case in a thousand, we tend to focus on the one case in a thousand which shows X. We focus on the dramatic story and that then somehow calls into question the aggregative weight of all the rest of the research. And again, I think it's to do with an erosion of faith in the scientific enterprise.
Thanks for that call. Do you see, Keith, conspiracy theories moving away from being something that everybody sees as fringe and making their way more into the mainstream in American politics in particular?
I mean, I certainly think one piece that I find enormously helpful and relevant still is a piece by Richard Hofstadter, written in 1964, called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And one of the things he points to there is the particular role of a feeling of political impotence in a very politicized situation. So this is the 1960s. He's writing about the 1950s. He's writing about the McCarthy movement. And I do think there's something about the turn that U.S. Party politics has taken, the ways in which the identities of Democrat and Republican have started to look and feel like some of those ethnic identities in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, whereby we don't talk across that line. We certainly don't marry across that line. We're creating these two different worlds of discourse, and I do think that has led to the conspiracy theories on both sides, not wishing to be, necessarily making strict equivalences, but I think the readiness to believe in the bad faith of others is stronger than it has been, I think, certainly before the mid-1990s.
I wanted to bring up the idea, Keith, of community, where people find a group of like-minded people who believe in the same theory. In the old days, it might have been they wrote back and forth or published a zine or something like that. Now they can find that community online. Not only do you have a shared interest, you have a shared idea that you're smarter than everybody. You've stumbled onto this thing that the public at large isn't aware of. Is that part of the appeal?
I think it is. I mean, it's one of the paradoxes of the new online social life that's now open to all of us. We can really insulate ourselves off from the neighbor who might have a lawn sign indicating that they believe something different from us. We can go online and think that we're living a full social life by interacting only with folks like us in one way or another. So I do think the social life, our social lives online play a part in this. And it's something that Robert Putnam, the sociologist, wrote about from the 1990s onwards. He reflected on the decline in church membership, bowling league membership, other forms of civic association that pulled people together who lived close to each other, who didn't necessarily have exactly the same set of beliefs, but they learned to compromise, they learned what subjects to avoid, they learned to find common ground where they could, and he saw that as very much part of the American way of being, as something very important in American society. And in some sense, the retreat online, the capabilities that moving our social lives online gives us, has really played a part in the erosion of that, what he called social capital, but also the erosion of the habits of making compromise and finding common ground.
In just a few seconds, 30 seconds or so, what do you suggest to your students when you're teaching them about how to not get caught up in a conspiracy theory?
So, as I mentioned, I'm an anthropologist by training. I just think that conversation, listening to others, and really turning the critical lens on yourself, if you find yourself convinced by an argument, looking at, flip it. Would you be equally convinced by the argument if all the evidence pointed the other way? Would you be equally open to it, or would you somehow find a way to reject it? And if, in fact, you find that you're applying double standards and you're holding different people telling you stories to different, you're subjecting them to different levels of scrutiny, then you might be on the pathway to becoming a conspiracy theorist.
And that's a good place to leave it. Thanks to our guest, Keith Brown, professor of politics and global studies, director of Arizona State University's Malikian Center. Join us today to talk about conspiracy theories, why they spread, and how they've changed in the era of the internet.